I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. During the presidential campaign, Donald Trump attracted voters who yearned for disruption. As it concludes its first month, few would disagree that his administration has delivered on that promise, big league. In a series of rambling perorations at his first solo press conference yesterday, the president said, as he often does, a whole bunch of stuff that isn't true. He also offered several opinions that many people agree with, that CNN is bad, that Fox and Friends is good, and that he was making progress fixing the terrible mess he was handed on January 20th. On the Midday News Wrap, we'll try, as we often do, to separate the wheat from the chaff and the fact from the fiction. Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the former mayor of Baltimore and an analyst for ABC News, Liz Copeland, the founder of the Urban Conservative Project, and Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television join me. The Midday News Wrap starts right after the news. And welcome to the Midday News Wrap, everybody. Very glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. There is plenty to talk about in this, the one-month mark in the Trump era. Some would say that the first 4 weeks of the Trump administration have been a frenetic, chaotic mess. Others would say that it's exactly what they hoped for when they voted for a disruptor. The president held forth for an hour and 17 minutes yesterday afternoon in his first solo press conference, ostensibly held to right this ship after a week filled with more than a few missteps. We'll talk about some of the big stories of the week, and we'll take your questions and comments. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stephanie Rawlings Blake joins us. She was the youngest person ever elected to the Baltimore City Council. She went on to become the president of the City Council and the mayor of Baltimore. She also served as the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. She left office last December, and now she's running a political consulting firm, SRB & Associates, and she is serving as a political commentator for ABC News. Welcome back in this new capacity. It's good to see you.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Liz Copeland is with us as well. She's the founder and president of the Urban Conservative Project. If you go to her website, you can find the answer to one of life's great existential questions, which is, are hipsters welcome?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Spoiler alert. They are. I was afraid to click the button because I am not a hipster. This just doesn't pertain to me.
Right.
Charles Robinson from MPT is here as well. He is the man for whom the term hipster was coined. And that's
just
convenient.
Just talking about that.
Exactly.
I doubt very seriously my kids would agree with that. But, you know, I'm the dude that's sitting on the end with the ladies.
That's right. You are here, you know, and as hip as ever. All right. Well, it's good to have all of you here. Stephanie, let's start with you. What was your impression of the press conference yesterday afternoon, which was really an extraordinary event in so many different ways?
Wow. I don't even know where to begin. I will say, I'm sure as many people, you almost believe that, it's hard to believe that it was true, that it was accurate, that your eyes were not deceiving you. But when I saw him ask April Ryan to arrange a meeting for him with the CBC, I was like, oh, yes, that's the Trump I know. The same Trump, you know, who calls us the blacks, who would assume that April Ryan is the administrative assistant for the Congressional Black Caucus. I think that speaks volumes of what he thinks about, you know, African Americans in this country. So I was very disappointed in the many of the answers that he gave, that he was not giving full answers for very important questions about his campaign's relationship with, in contact with Russia, the way that he has consistently demeaned the media is also a concern. And again, I was just aghast with this notion that just because April Ryan's African American reporter that she was supposed to have the hookup for him with the Congressional Black Caucus.
Let's listen to a clip of that in case some of our listeners didn't get a chance to catch it yesterday.
Are you going to include the CBC, Mr. President, in your conversations with your urban agenda, your inner city agenda, as well as you going to include the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional
Well,
Hispanic
I would.
Caucus,
I tell you what, do you want to set up the meeting? Do you want to set up the meeting?
No.
Are they friends of yours?
I'm just a reporter.
Set up the meeting.
I know some of them, but I'm sure
Let's
they're
Let's go set up
right
a
now.
Meeting. I would love to meet with the Black Caucus. I think it's great, the Congressional Black Caucus. I think it's great. I actually thought I had a meeting with Congressman Cummings, and he was all excited, And then he said, oh, I can't move. It might be bad for me politically. I can't have that meeting. I was all set to have the meeting. You know, we called him and called him, and he was all set. I spoke to him on the phone. Very nice guy.
I hear he wanted that meeting with you as well.
He wanted it. But we called. They can't make a meeting with him. Every day I walk in, I said, I would like to meet with him because I do want to solve the problem. But he probably was told by Schumer or somebody like that, some other lightweight, he was probably told, don't meet with Trump. It's bad politics.
All right, so we don't have time because it's not a 57-hour program to dissemble every remark he made yesterday. But here, just for the record, is Congressman Cummings' response to that allegation by the president.
I think basically his staff gave him some incorrect information because they know that we have been wanting to meet with him with regard to the high prices of prescription drugs. One thing he did not say is that on January the 19th, Cedric Richmond, the chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, wrote to the president asking for a meeting, and they have gotten no response to date. And so maybe the president will give him a call tomorrow, but I'm happy to meet with the president. Keep in mind, this is my president, this is your president for the next 4 years.
Was it odd that the president asked White House correspondent April Ryan to set up a meeting between himself and the leadership of the Congressional Black Caucus?
Yeah, I thought that was a little different, but I imagine what happened is he saw an African-American woman connected with the Congressional Black Caucus and said maybe they're friends.
So Liz Copeland, interesting kind of diplomatic response from Congressman Cummings, who's saying, you know, let's not burn this bridge. Let's not go after him too strongly. What's your reaction to all that?
That's what you expect from someone who's in a position to speak for all of his constituents. And he's right. Congressman Cummings, he acknowledged that that's his president, that his success is our success. But I want to go back to the statement that our president made about April Ryan regarding setting up the meeting. I think it's typical Donald Trump. He was very flippant. It is offensive for him to make those statements, but I don't believe that our president realizes how offensive he is, because he is the same person he was as president, as a candidate, is who he is as a president. And his statement still got him into the White House, and there's no one there that's really balancing him, that's pulling him back. There's no one telling him that he shouldn't make those statements. He shouldn't have this kind of unhinged, self-absorbed rant as a press conference. Republicans would have never given Barack Obama that kind of pass if he had had that sort of press conference. And I think it's incumbent upon the members, the leaders of my party, to stand up and speak out. There was no one.
Remind folks that you're a Republican.
I am a Republican. Nobody. No one said anything negative. No one was quoted that said anything negative about the press conference. But keep in mind, a poll, I think it was 85% of Donald Trump supporters loved it. They loved every bit of it.
You bet.
Every bit of it. So that press conference just it didn't win him any friends. He didn't lose any of his supporters. But it certainly isn't bringing the country together.
Yeah. Charles Robinson, I was struck by the brutishness of it and just the lack of politeness. I mean, he stepped over almost everybody who spoke to him. We've all probably been in meetings with men like this, and I have never been in a meeting where there's a woman who's acted like this. But the guys who just won't even let you get the word, you know, the thought out of your head before they're just stepping all over it. Just the lack of courtesy, the common decency was stunning to me.
Well, first and foremost, let me, as a disclaimer, say that I've known April Ryan for over 20-plus years. She is a friend of mine. We often talk. And in fact, we were having conversations prior to that press conference because there was an incident that happened a couple of days, the week before that, regarding Omarosa and April Ryan and a confrontation. And I had to...
Omarosa is the former guest
apprentice on Apprentice,
who is now working in a PR position somewhere in the administration.
Oh, I just want to interject. That's not really her. She has a PhD in communication. She worked in Bill Clinton's White House. So when people minimize her political experience, I personally want to make sure that we get the record.
That's how folks know her.
She isn't helping her to connect with Donald Trump.
I want to get back to the original question. Understand this, that this is a president who has never held elected office. And there is always a learning curve. I don't care what level you serve at, from the highest level to the lowest level, where you sometimes you have to be confrontational. Sometimes you have to challenge facts. And, you know, April was just one of several reporters who were in that room. I'm reminded of the Jewish reporter who asked a question, and it was flipped on him as to whether or not he was anti-Semitic. Jim Acosta, who is a CNN reporter, who was challenging facts. I don't want to say this is the new normal, but, you know, we all have to almost take a deep breath because this president is different. And I think the only currency that journalists have, and I'm not talking about commentators, I'm talking about journalists, is truth. And, you know, there was a challenge to this president as to whether or not he had the highest electoral votes of any first he said, I had the highest electoral votes. Then he said, well, I had the highest Republican electoral votes. Well, no, that was wrong. And the question was this trust issue. Because understand the main reason.
And then he said that was some information people gave me. As if it's their fault. It's never his fault.
Right, right. But the other part was the reason primarily for this was to stop the bleeding from a really bad week. I mean, think about it. We lost the national security director. We also lost the labor secretary. We had tough fights on the secretary of education, Betty DeVos. And, you know, the question was, you know, are you paying attention? And the question, I think afterwards, people still asking the question, is the president focused on people or is he focused on himself? Yeah. Because I heard a lot of
Yeah, that's for sure.
And so, but, you know, look, he is the president of the United States. He was duly elected by the Electoral College. I think people want him to be the president of the United States. And, you know, there are going to be people on either side of this
and
issue.
And perhaps, as Liz has said, yeah. You know, the people who wanted that are getting it and they're perfectly happy with it. And the folks who didn't want it are, you know, continue to be appalled. Yeah. I mean, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, you have had to staff up an administration. When you took over office, mm-hmm. you replaced the former mayor, Sheila Dixon, who was, you know, removed from office. So you had to do it quickly. Mm-hmm. When people say this is a chaotic situation, and Mr. Trump himself referred to people's characterization as chaotic in these first few weeks, is that your take as well? And is there a way, if in fact that narrative rings true to most folks, is there a way of getting it less chaotic in short order?
It's chaotic because he has surrounded himself with people who thrive on chaos. And it's chaotic because he, as Charles said, this is his first time in elected office, and he didn't value preparation. So he certainly didn't prepare on how to roll out a transition, how to plan. When you have a transition and you want it to be orderly, you give people the heads up about the things that you're going to do. This is what we plan to do first. This is what we plan to do second. These are the people who we plan to use to engage, to help us to make these decisions. None of those things happen. So there is, when you don't have a plan, things look haphazard. And when you insist on rushing and having these knee-jerk reactions to big policy issues, you're going to continue to have things like the very poorly written executive order that...
And he referred to that rollout yesterday as smooth and perfect. He called the administration a fine-tuned machine. It's interesting. He's labeling things in a very different way than others.
And I will say that... you know, I hope that is not the same fine-tuned machine that he has promised that American manufacturing will be producing with all these new jobs he's going to bring back to the Rust Belt. So, it is clear that many people voted for him because they wanted change. They wanted a disruptor, and they've got it. Every minute of every day, they have a disruptor. Does that mean that he has a fine-tuned machine and a seamless transition or implementation of this new administration? Absolutely not. But as Liz said, his supporters don't care a bit about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. And of course, for years, people on the political right have said that, you know, we need a business person running the government. Well, we have one. So this is an interesting experiment, if nothing else, to see if this person's business acumen, which is evidently, you know, demonstrable, although who knows how much money he's actually worth. But we'll see. And we will have more of this conversation on the Midday News Wrap with Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, Charles Robinson, and Liz Copeland when we come back after a little break. 410-662-8780 is how you can join the melee here. Midday@WIPR.org is our email address and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, we'll meet Daryl Davis. He's the subject of a documentary on PBS called Accidental Courtesy. Mr. Davis, who is a black man, made it his mission to befriend and then convert members of the Ku Klux Klan. He'll join me along with Dr. Ray Winbush of Morgan State University and licensed social worker Dr. Gilbert Bliss to talk about different approaches to confronting racism. That's coming up Monday here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it is the Midday News Wrap. We're talking about events of the week as this first month of the Trump administration comes to a close. Liz Copeland of the Urban Conservative Project, Charles Robinson from MPT, and former Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake join me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Liz Copeland, let's talk about this being one of the leakiest White Houses in recent memory. The latest leak comes from the AP today, about an hour and a half ago, which is a document that they've obtained saying that the Trump administration is considering a proposal to put as many as 100,000 National Guard troops on the ground to round up unauthorized immigrants, going as far east as New Orleans, Louisiana, perhaps as far north as Portland, Oregon. This is an 11-page memo that's being circulated around the White House. This is probably another example of something that the president wishes weren't in the public domain at this juncture. What do you think that says about the people who are working for Mr. Trump?
I think it's obvious that he certainly doesn't have supporters inside of the intelligence community. I mean, it's well known that not just Donald Trump, but General Flynn have enemies inside, you know, the intelligence community. And leaking classified information is a federal crime. And there are people, according to published reports within these communities, who are talking to The Washington Post, talking to The New York Times, saying that we don't want to give all of the classified information to the president because we're afraid of what he's going to do with it. That's serious. That's a serious concern for all of Americans. And it's important that we are safe, and it's important for our commander-in-chief to be able to receive information, you know, analyze it, digest this, and make decisions that's in our best interest and that keeps us safe. With the General Flynn leaking and now this one regarding immigration, some of it feels like red meat for the media, though. There's something about it that I'm sure there's other information that is, if not more important, but seriously important, especially with Russia 13 miles off of the coast of the United States in international waters, but just so close. I'm sure there's other things there, but these that are being leaked are hitting the buttons of the media, the people that are paying attention, and it's causing us to have a conversation about it. So I think we need to think about the motives of the leakers and how it's going to really impact our country's security.
So Tom, as the one reporter here at the table, let me talk a little bit about sources and information, because I get a lot of stuff that I don't publish, and people call me, and sometimes there are outlandish, sometimes there's some truth to it. At the federal level, understand this. Yes, there are people who have access to crime, no doubt about that. But any reporter worth their salt will tell you that you can't go with any piece of information unless you get, I like to say, three confirmations. Those of us who read All the President's Men back in the day from William Bernstein, they talked about this idea that you can't have one source on a given subject matter.
So that when the Wall Street Journal publishes a front page A1 above the fold article that says their sources are telling them that the intelligence community is reluctant to share information with the President of the United States, you think that's credible?
not just credible, but I'm the Wall Street Journal is a valued media property, and I'm sure they follow the tenets of what good journalism is, you know, and sometimes that's a moving target. But the other part of that is this, is simply this. When you get material that is of a salacious nature, and trust me, I get a lot of salacious stuff, and you know, you got to go, really? But I think the other part of that is that you kind of, you know, people talk about anonymous sources. You don't give everybody that anonymous source. First and foremost, I have a real simple rule on that. Will this hurt, harm, kill, or cause someone to do the unthinkable? That's
and the Wall Street Journal, you know, had those discussions and made it. Right. Made it. On the other hand, BuzzFeed, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, had a discussion that said, you know, this dossier that nobody's been able to confirm is also printable, publishable. But the consequences here for the leader of the free world to be having information withheld, do you think, as you read those articles, do you think that the intelligence community is leery of Mr. Trump personally or leery of the people in the White House that we were just talking about who are, it seems, more than willing to share some information that shouldn't be shared, perhaps?
You know, I wanted to try to circle around to all of these comments. There doesn't need to be a leak about his lack of judgment when it comes to security information. It was broadcast on television when he was getting a national security briefing out in the open in his restaurant. So we don't need a leak.
Yeah, he's down at Mar-a-Lago having dinner with the Prime Minister of Japan.
The question I have, you know, as you know, for the reporters, like, we have to expect that any professional in the intelligence community would automatically be concerned about sharing things if he is that cavalier with national security information that in any other circumstance has to be secreted away, and he is doing this out in the public. It's not a surprise.
Yourself, I'm going to go back. This man has never served in a capacity as a mayor, governor, dog catcher, whatever.
But there are some things that are just basic tenets that anyone who's paying attention would think, common sense would say, security briefing? Let's be secure while I'm reading this, while I'm being briefed.
So I don't think it's necessarily, it needs to be, you know, it's I don't think it's that far-fetched that secured, that our national intelligence professionals who have been trained, who have experience, would have these concerns. It's not rocket science.
But I don't think it's necessarily new that maybe mid-level professionals have some concern about the incoming president. Now, their positions are supposed to be apolitical. They're there to serve, you know, the public and keep us safe.
Do we forget about Comey? Do we forget about the fact that when it worked out for the Republicans?
Who has, by the way, decided not to pursue any investigation into General Flynn, who may or may not have lied to the FBI, which is, of course,
well, James Clapper, he lied to Congress and to the public about the metadata, and he kept his job. So let's be clear about, you know, people who keep
and
their
you're
job.
Right. And you're right, Liz. Two wrongs make a right.
No. But two rights made an airplane. But I do know that we have selective memory when we're talking about standards and how we apply them to administrative officials. My point is that I'm certain that when Barack Obama came into office, who had no foreign policy, with not significant foreign policy experience, I'm sure there were some people who were a little hesitant about his ability to govern and to take the information. But he came in and he held a standard and he demonstrated to the world that he was able to get information and make decisions that were in the best interest of the country. We have not seen that from this president. So, and that's concerning.
What have we learned so far?
That we have a lot of leaks.
Two rights make an airplane. That's a good one, Liz. That's a good one. You're listening to the Midday News Wrap, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Liz Copeland, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, and Charles Robinson join me here in Studio A. Let's go to the phones. Michael in Baltimore, welcome to the News Wrap. Thanks for your call.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for having me on. Hi, everybody. I just wanted to comment quickly and just ask a question of the guest and what their perception is on this, that as a progressive, as somebody who supported Bernie Sanders in the primary, voted for Hillary Clinton, and somebody who typically does not support the policies of Donald Trump in any way, shape, or form, I will say, though, that in my lifetime, I've never seen such established media outlets as the New York Times seem to me always factual. They always write, and their stories are well-crafted and seem to be factual in manner when I read them, but seem to me to be awfully biased and really dedicated to discrediting Donald Trump. When you see the headlines on CNN, they are absolutely dedicated to sensational media as it's related to Donald Trump. And it's the same on the other side, and I really think that they've picked up a cue from Fox News, from Nat Review, from other outlets that have been doing this for a long time.
So,
and
Michael, let me ask you to give me an example of the New York Times or CNN or the Washington Post writing a biased article against Mr. Trump.
No, I want to clarify too that I always think that their reporting is sound and factual, and I depend on it, you know, in my daily life. But if I go on the NewYorkTimes.com right now, though I would agree with this characterization, Trump defends fine-tuned machine. In quotes, in 77 chaotic minutes. So the headlines, especially, are always these sensational headlines directed towards, you know, Mr. Trump. And I feel like that I'm sensing a narrative and an objective politically more so than I ever have with a lot of well-established media. And I just, it's been a bit disturbing, though, again, factual stories you could read under these headlines. It's been just a bit disturbing for me as a political observer and somebody who's interested in the, you know, in the news and how information is digested and how it is proffered to people.
Great. Well, thank you for the call, Michael. I appreciate it. Of course, you know, there were plenty of people who characterized yesterday's press conference as chaotic, and I think Mr. Trump did attempt to defend this thing that he himself called, you know, a fine-tuned machine. So that's, again, a quote directly from the source in that particular instance. But again, you know, editorial decisions are always, you know, ripe for criticism.
I think I want to give some, I want to support Michael's question, because I've read The Washington Post, The New York Times, CNN, and while I do understand, well, first of all, we need to have a free press. And Donald Trump he's declared war. He's waging war against the press. I don't think that's the smartest thing. Two, he lives in an alternate reality. He makes statements that are not clear, that are not comprehensible, and they're not factual. So the press needs to provide the public with accurate facts. Three, I noticed their adjective choices. In the most recent article in, I think it was CNN or the Washington Post, they talked about the ICE raids that happened about a week and a half ago. And they put in quotations that the ICE raids were, they had been planned. But they quoted planned, not the whole sentence, not three words, just planned. And to, you know, an average reader, you're just looking at it, it kind of struck me as odd that they would only quote, you know, put quotations around that one word. It was almost as if they didn't believe the official's words as accurate.
Well, again, I mean, I think in any story, in anything, you could quibble with this word or
but,
that word. Or
right,
that.
But there's a lot of tone that's setting a narrative that
And Mr. Trump
clear.
Talked about a tone that he thought was, you know, very, very anti-Trump and very, very divisive. And of course, there are other people who say, well, the divisiveness that we have in our country is caused in large measure by the campaign that he waged.
I think, you know, Michael points out a reader, viewer, online person who sometimes is in silos because they kind of go, you know what, I want to hear what attracts me. The people who write the headlines don't always write the articles. That's one of the things that I don't think the general public knows. But the other part is you know, everybody's, you know, even public television where I work, we're trying to get people to come to see us and watch us, read us, and whatever. But our jobs as reporters are not to be public relations advocates. That's why you hire people like that. You hire people to come in and say, hey, look, what's our message of the day? And I know the former mayor can tell you that every day we had a message that we wanted to get out. The other part is that you're not going to like us a lot. I'm okay with that. I mean, trust me, I've been called some pretty nasty names by some pretty high-ranking people. And guess what? I go home and bed at night, and I sleep well.
And continue being hip. That's it. Every day, Charles. Every day, Charles.
I don't know about being him.
Let's go back to the phones before we take a quick break. Todd from Frederick, welcome to the Midday News Wrap with Liz Copeland, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, and Charles Robinson. Glad to have you on the show.
I appreciate taking the call. Thank you. Yeah, I just, of course, was calling just to express my extreme concern of, you know, it's hard to say, President Trump's news conference yesterday, you know, he did come across as, one, just being an extreme narcissist, very demeaning and confrontational. And, you know, the biggest thing that, you know, I took out of that was he was, you know, again, very demeaning of our military, you know, put it down as far as, like, I guess you said something to the fact that, oh, he's used the weapons and, you know, and again, taken on a whole mess. So for a president who, you know, should say he's taken on challenges instead of mess, what do we as Americans do to, I guess, you know, express or provide our, you know, dissent with, you know, some of his words? Because he did come across as talking as off, you know, he was on his, you know, heels walking backwards.
Well, thank you for your call, Todd. I appreciate it. We have an email from Dan in Chestertown who says, I realize that the term malignant narcissism is the proper clinical diagnosis. And I don't know if Dan is a psychiatrist or not, and I'm not sure if it's the proper clinical diagnosis, but Dan goes on to say, but after that 77 minutes diatribe yesterday, I submit that the more precise description would be wacko. He needs serious psychotherapeutic help. You know, there's two things that come to mind when I hear a comment like that. Number one, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, does that advance the conversation?
I hope you're not thinking of me.
No, the first thing I think about
when I hear things like that is Stephanie Rawlings-Blake.
Yeah, that's right. Psychotherapeutic help is needed.
I hope you don't intend on a return visit.
I do not. I am not linking those two things. What I'm linking is Dan's comment, and you know, E.J. Dion writing a column yesterday says, you know, the president is unfit for office. That's essentially the columns he was writing in July, too, before he was elected. David Brooks in the New York Times using the terms unhinged, unglued. I mean, people are questioning his mental stability. As a member of the opposition party, as a ranking officer in the Democratic National Committee, is that the way to structure and to formulate an argument against this particular political movement?
You know, so I'll go back to the gentleman that had a question, two questions ahead that said it seems like, you know, he said, I'm not a Trump supporter, but it seems like there is this this thirst for anti-Trump news. But the challenge is, what else is a reporter to do when every single time he opens his mouth, he reveals more and more that he is unfit to serve? Every time he opens his mouth, there's no depth to which he won't go to be offensive, to be a bully. He is such a hypocrite. It's shameful, you know, to throw out his alternative facts about his electoral college votes. You know, he threw them out two or three different ways, and when challenged, they said, "Well, oh, someone told me that." He spent the 18 months calling Secretary Clinton lying Hillary, yet he is putting out false information and as you know, whatever, somebody told me this. It is difficult. We're in a very challenging place right now because every time he opens his mouth, he is giving us reason to question his mental stability, his fitness for office. And when we talk about it, we're called bias or fake news. And that will continue to be a challenge for anyone in the public who wants to have a discourse about this, and the media, because I guarantee you today he's going to do something else that will call to question his judgment.
It'll make us forget about what happened yesterday.
Yeah. But Tom, I just want to say this. He was right. He received the most Republican votes in the primary. He received 13 million votes, 2 million more than George Bush. But why are we relitigating how many votes that he got in a primary?
That's my point.
He's, why is he relitigating this issue at a press conference? So we have to be, the facts are he did get the most Republican votes in a Republican primary, and he won the Electoral College. He is our president.
Not by the margins he was adducing.
No.
In the election, 11 million more people voted against
him
than voted for him
this,
to win.
All factually correct. But why is he talking about this? Yeah. As president, we have all of these other issues that should be addressed.
Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is the former mayor of Baltimore and the current head of SRB & Associates, a political consulting firm. Charles Robinson is a reporter for Maryland Public Television and other outlets. Liz Copeland is the founder and president of the Urban Conservative Project. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap when we return from a quick break. 410-662-8780 is how you can reach us here at the News Wrap. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Unfortunately, much of the media in Washington, D.C., along with New York, Los Angeles, in particular, speaks not for the people, but for the special interests and for those profiting off a very, very obviously broken system. The press has become so dishonest that if we don't talk about it, we are doing a tremendous disservice to the American people. Tremendous disservice. We have to talk about it to find out what's going on, because the press honestly is out of control. The level of dishonesty is out of control.
President Donald Trump at his press conference yesterday in Washington. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Friday on Midday is the day we have the Midday News Wrap, where we chat amiably about some of the big news stories of the week. Our panel today, former Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, who's now an analyst with ABC Television and the head of a consulting firm called SRB & Associates. Liz Copeland is the founder and president of the Urban Conservative Project, and Charles Robinson, who covers national and local politics and business for Maryland Public Television and other news organizations. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Julia in Baltimore, welcome to the show. Thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you. My comment is, what kind of action would you expect from an egotist, a braggart, and a bully? And as far as I can tell, the only true statement this man has ever made is the world is in trouble, and he's the root of it.
Well, thank you for your call, Julie. I appreciate it. Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, this notion of how the opposition should formulate a strategy. Let's talk about what's going on with the race to be the next chair of the DNC. You are currently the secretary, I guess, running for that office again. Mm-hmm. So we'll find out next week in Atlanta whether you retain that office. But you've got figures like Keith Ellison, Tom Perez. You've got the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who's been endorsed by Martin O'Malley, Pete Buttigieg. Am I saying his name right? Do you have any idea?
Pete. Yeah.
Pete. Yeah, that's right. Where do you think the party stands in terms of consensus around, number one, a leader for the DNC, and number two, a strategy moving forward?
So I think there is so much eagerness to get to next weekend for a number of reasons. And the fact that we need to have a unified voice, a very focused, intentional pushback or resistance against the Trump administration is I think, a top priority. So to say consensus, I think that consensus will be shown next weekend. And I think anyone who suggests that there's a consensus before that vote happens is, I don't think being accurate. We're blessed to have a lot of great candidates who are seeking leadership in the DNC at many levels, including mine. The challenge will be who the party officials believe will do the best job to be the voice for our party, to plan our fight moving forward. And I hope one of the things that people are considering it, as I certainly am, is who have the best shot of bringing us together. Because I think what the primary showed me was, we could spend a lot of time fighting among ourselves and miss the bigger picture. And I think the most important fight was for the future of the country. And a lot of us decided that it was about the future of the Democratic, you know, the future of the Democratic Party was more important, you know, based on some of the fights that were happening, at you know, the political fights that were happening. And America's suffering because of that.
Have you endorsed anybody for a leader?
No, and, you know, I'm a couple of reasons why that would be a challenge. Not only am I a sitting officer, but I'm, as the secretary, my office administers the race. So we certify the petitions, mm-hmm. You know, send out the ballot, the proxies. It makes it difficult, particularly in light of what happened a few months ago with the party and the email hacking. It makes it difficult to... I think it would make it difficult for me to take a position in the race.
Fair enough. Liz Copeland, the resistance to the Trump administration, such as it is, it's interesting. It's not coming from Washington at the moment. Perhaps it will when the Democrats do elect a leader in Atlanta next weekend. But, for example, we have Andy Harris, the only Republican member of the Maryland Congressional Caucus, holding a virtual town hall meeting either yesterday or today. I can't remember. I've lost track. I think it was yesterday. Because around the country, he's finding colleagues in the Congress who are confronting the kinds of crowds that the Tea Party ginned up 8 years ago, 10 years ago, around things like the ACA and Social Security, Medicare, et cetera. Is this opposition, we had the Women's March, you know, around the world, just millions of people organizing in various cities around the planet the day after the inauguration. How will Republicans navigate what's turning out to be a fairly difficult row to hoe with their putative leader?
That's a great question, and I don't think there's a simple answer to that. But I do want to clarify one thing about Congressman Harris. He has historically held electronic tele-town hall meetings. So this town hall meeting isn't in direct response to the number of individuals who've spoken up and out at other Republican congressmen. All I can say is that he has always had teletown meetings. I think it was because of the Obamacare town hall meetings that caused him to do that when he came into office. So he hasn't broken from his tradition. Would it be helpful for him to be live in front of his constituents? Absolutely. Is he going to feel the heat? Absolutely. I think that's what your congressperson should get. They should get in-person experience from their constituents. As far as the topic of many of those who are organizing these town hall meetings with or without their congressional representatives or people who are organizing demonstrations, one, you know, you have the right, you should exercise your right to speak out when you think things aren't going right. And so with the Women's March, even though I... you know, surprisingly, I'm pro-choice. I'm pro-marriage equality. I'm certain I agree with a lot of the things that the women who organized that march are marching for. At that time, I said it was important for us to support our president. But, you know, it's hard to be a Republican and say that when the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated, Mitch McConnell said, we're going to make him a one-term president. It's exactly. Hard to say, hey, Democrats, don't be an opposition party. You're not my opponent. You're my neighbor. You're my friend. Let's work together. When I recall 8 years ago, the way the GOP held their position, how they opposed a lot of things coming into Congress, which forced the president, which contributed to the president really exercising executive power.
Sure. And hey, the Democrats have to decide. Do you, for example, you know, filibuster Neil Gorsuch in the Supreme Court, et cetera?
One of the things I think, as I look from the outside at each one of these groups, is the decentralization of what is called party. You know, each has had both wanes and, you know, dips in their popularity. But I think this last election cycle showed us this whole idea that you better start talking to people. Yeah. And if you don't start, I'm sorry about that. If you don't start talking to people, guess what? You're going to be out of office. I mean, it was true during the first Obama presidency when he lost the Congress. He began to lose the Senate. And we began to see around this country state houses change. Because I cover a state house, I see where this stuff is beginning and where it's spreading. And if you don't start working at those state houses, I don't care if you're a Republican, Democrat, or a Bernie Sanders, or you know, Linda LaRouche person. You better start working at those state houses, because guess what? They draw congressional lines.
Right. Yeah. And during the Obama administration, the Democratic Party lost, I think 14 40, or 15. The Republicans
close
now
to
1,000
seats in state legislatures.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know,
that's a significant amount.
And then what happens? I mean, for example, the NRA had a big victory just the other day that went kind of under the radar screen because so much else was going on. But Congress has sent to the president legislation that he will sign, which will block President Obama's rule, which was instituted after the Newtown shooting, to prevent an estimated 75,000 people with mental disorders to be able to purchase a firearm. Senator Charles Grassley from Iowa led the opposition, saying that this was an infringement on the rights of the mentally disabled, and it was discriminatory, and we should let these folks get guns.
And I'm an NRA member, and I supported that measure. It's common sense. It just makes sense. We need to make sure that people who have a diagnosed mental health condition do not have access to guns.
Yep. That doesn't
Unfortunately,
happen anymore.
I'm the minority within not just my party, but within that organization.
Let's see if we can sneak in a couple more calls before we finish up today. Mike in Severn, welcome to the news wrap. Thanks for your call.
Hi, Tom, and guest. I just thought that Trump missed a great opportunity yesterday to talk to the issues that a lot of the people that supported him are interested in, whether that's protecting the safety net, not touching Social Security, making sure that they have better health insurance than they have today. What I feel is happening is he's being whipsawed by a very hard right set of advisors, and the Republicans, who are going to own all of this, are going to drive the bus. You know, he's like the emperor has no clothes. Because he has no hard, fast opinions on or values about anything, he's easily led.
Interesting. Well, Mike, thank you for your call. Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, I mean, a lot of folks say it's not his advisors. He's, in fact, ignoring his advisors. Others, like Mike, perhaps think he's just getting bad advice. Yesterday, there was a narrative that said the reason he went out is that he was shoving his surrogates aside. He didn't want Kellyanne Conway and Sean Spicer trying to defend
him.
Yeah, right, exactly.
No, I mean, listen, it doesn't get better, whether he's using his judgment or the judgment of his advisors. It's not going to get better. We've seen that when left to his own devices, he, if not unhinged, certainly is wearing that suit. So, you know, he's certainly doing a good impersonation of an unhinged individual. And we know the judgment and the values of the people that he's surrounded himself with. And so I don't think, you know, whether it's him on the front lines or listening to his advisors, that we're going to get better outcomes. It's clear that he is, that he is focused on a very right agenda, an agenda that values a small very specific population in the country, and the rest of us can, you know, go to double hockey sticks, as my mom used to say.
Well, we are going to have to make that the last word. I am very grateful to all of you. We will end on the double hockey sticks.
We ended on the double hockey
sticks. But thank you very much.
H-E
double hockey sticks. Thank you all for being here. Former mayor, Baltimore mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. She's a commentator for ABC News now, and she runs SRB & Associates, a political consulting firm. Charles Robinson, he reports on business and politics for Maryland Public Television. And Liz Copeland, she's the founder and CEO of the Urban Conservative Project and a former Republican candidate for the Baltimore City Council. That'll do it for this edition of the Midday News Wrap. Coming up Monday on the show, an African-American man sets out to change the hearts and minds of members of the Ku Klux Klan. Daryl Davis tells us his story, which is the subject of a new film called Accidental Courtesy, which recently screened on PBS. We'll be joined by Dr. Ray Winbush from Morgan State University and Dr. Gil Bliss. He's a social worker who does anti-racism training. By the way, coming up on the show Tuesday, Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis will join me for the hour take my questions and your calls and comments. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. He's also the vice president of intergalactic communication. If you're listening to this from a different dimension, please email lspicknall@wypr.org. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coghlan from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provides production assistance. And finally, good luck to the O's. They are holding their first full squad workout of the season today in Sarasota, Florida. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Monday. Have a great President's Day weekend.